This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Are you doing good?
I'm doing pretty good. So all right. For our listeners who are maybe unable to call in during the normal show time, we now have a voicemail and an unattended voicemail box where you can call in, ask some questions, maybe make a comment or or something like that. So the number for that is 714-900-2601. So we're going to take a question from that voicemail listener who left us a message, and we'll get you coming, Dr. Lyle.
All right.
Hey, Nate and Dr. Lyle. I'm obviously a guy from the sound of my voice, and I think that one of my biggest weaknesses is my passiveness and sometimes indecisiveness, and I hate that at times because I'm not able to take charge and I can't make confident decisions in a group setting. And I feel that this is an even bigger setback as a guy, as it kind of makes me look weak and ineffective sometimes. So I was wondering if there was any techniques I could use to help offset this weakness, especially since I'm sort of in a position where I'm expected to lead and manage in my role at work. So I'd love to hear your answer, and thanks for taking my call.
Interesting. So what this sounds like is it sounds like a highly agreeable personality. And so a highly agreeable personality in certain circumstances is going to be an uncomfortable in a leadership position. So I'm trying to think off the top of my head how I've seen this done, because I have seen it done. I think that usually the best method for somebody like this to utilize is to essentially be asking a lot of questions of your team. What do people and have it be a repetitive process that this is how it is that you go about making decisions. In other words, so we're going to go around the room. Okay, what do we think? We would structure these questions in a way that would make sense. What do we think? What are some strengths to this thing? What are some weaknesses to it? Where are our vulnerabilities? What are people thinking? And let's just kind of go around, round table this thing. Mark, what are some of your thoughts on this? And so this is in essence, you're kind of looking at two different leadership styles, and a couple of examples of this would be the two different Star Trek captains. So Captain Kirk was a more traditional alpha, where he would certainly ask his staff for information, but then he would make decisions and he would be bold and decisive. Whereas Picard was much more what I am referring to, okay? Much more agreeable personality. Certainly not without strength, but a very different way of going about doing things, where he would be consulting and listening and asking questions, and essentially let that process. And in other words, if you don't want to find yourself contradicting or arguing with your subordinates, then what you want to do is you want to facilitate a process or a social situation where everybody is safe to be contradicting each other. And that's why we set up this by saying things like, well, what are the pluses of that? What might be some of the minuses? And so we make it so that there's not very much on the line, that people aren't taking strong positions. And what we're doing is we're essentially triangulating as a group on what we think the best decision is. Okay. That's, and we can leave with, hey, this is what I think we're going to do. And I can, you know, I can see that there's different avenues we can take, but I think this is the way, this is the direction we're going to go. And that way you didn't take a strong position and you didn't have to lead. Essentially we led from the closest thing we could get to a consensus. And that's probably how you can be actually quite effective in a quote leadership role, rather than trying to be something you're not, which is decisive and bold. So that's how I would handle that.
Now, do you think that other five factor, the other personalities of the big five are going to be more important as a leader if you are also agreeable? For example, like would someone, if they are agreeable, they need to be more intelligent than someone who's naturally more disagreeable?
I'm trying to think about what, as a leader, I'm not even sure what our goal is here. It's a good question, but we got to ask it in context. So if we're trying to talk about effective leadership, it matters a great deal about what is the decision-making process that the leaders are going through and for what reason. So if you are, if you're in a military situation where you're going to have to be making decisions and somebody's going to get a really, really bad end of the stick, and there's really no way out, then intelligence doesn't matter. What matters is enough disagreeableness, and enough, you know, sort of conscientiousness, but not too much, but just enough conscientiousness and a hell of a lot of disagreeableness, to just say, hey, this is the way it is. You're taking the hill. You're not. That's it. That's hardly the best decision-making strategy for 50,001 other problems in life. So kind of what I would tell you, Nathan, is that there's horses for courses. Mm-hmm. And this person could be a perfectly fine leader in a lot of situations, but the situation that he happens to be in, there may not be an adaptation that is very effective. This is the best move that he can make to essentially try to lead as close as possible by consensus. And that's a leadership in quotes. It actually is leadership. It's just leadership of a particular style where sudden major risks are not necessary to be taken without consultation, where you're just having to go with, you know, essentially the leader's gut on a given, you know, decision. So yeah, every situation, every group process is different, and therefore every leadership problem would have a different sort of ideal personality that would fit it. And however, if you're highly agreeable in general, that puts you in a bad position to quote be leading anything. And but obviously intelligence, for example, and conscientiousness are just generally good traits to have to minimize risk, because it's going to improve your ability to make better decisions. So all things being equal, what you would want is a highly intelligent, highly conscientious leader, but you would want someone that would be at least in the middle of the bell curve for disagreeable. Because they're going to need group decisions are inherently going to piss off a significant amount of the group, and for the individual to be able to carry that off without sort of, you know, being turned into rubble by an internal mutinous disagreeable process, you got to have some gonads. So if you don't have a lot of gonads, the best way to do it is to try to lead by consensus.
Fascinating. And I guess that makes sense because even with few exceptions, even the U.S. presidents have almost never get more than, you know, 50-60% of the vote So they're always going to have about 50% of people not liking them and their ideas.
Oh, yeah. There's always going to be constant conflict, tension, outrage, etc. You better be fairly disagreeable, which, you know, all presidents are going to be. If you're there's no super nice guy. Actually, the closest thing we probably ever had to a really nice guy, I think, was probably Jimmy Carter. And, I think the presidency was extremely hard for him. I think his conscientiousness and his nice guy-ness made that a particularly harrowing experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's my guess.
Now, Dr. Lai, I'm sure we've talked before on the show about the natural born leaders and how this, some of this may be genetic.
Sure.
Do we know what charisma is in terms of the combination of the big five?
Well, a whole hell of a lot of this is just disagreeable, is what it is. So that's what most successful leadership is disagreeable with a bunch of conscientiousness. That's pretty much what it is. Nothing real special. They don't have to be particularly bright. When we look at political leadership, obviously it depends on what domain we're talking about. If we're talking about the high tech world, you better be really smart. But if you're talking about general political process, most political leaders around the world are probably moderately above average in intelligence. They're pretty darn conscientious and they're disagreeable as hell. That's what drives that. Quote, charisma is mostly, I fully intend to get to the top of the dominance hierarchy, and I'm going to keep talking and keep posturing and keep trying to get attention to get there. That's what it is.
Yeah. Wow. I wish it was more complicated than that so we can go off on a longer answer.
Yeah, it's just an animal instinct of this primate to try to get to the top of a local dominance hierarchy. And so most of us, even though we may have that in us, a great many men have a desire to be dominant. However, you find out that you're running into each other all over the place, even on the playground. And so the idea of who the hell is going to go to the trouble to try to get on the top of a major dominance hierarchy, particularly one that isn't being sorted by some kind of an objective process with respect to ability. So if you're trying to be the head surgeon at Stanford Medical School, good luck to you. You're going to have to impress the hell out of a hell of a lot of people over a long period of time with just sheer brilliance and greater ability than other people. If you're trying to, win, some major piano competition, there's going to be objective evidence that's going to be examined, and you're going to be forced to compete in that sort of a way. And so you don't have to be really an ornery cuss. You might just be very talented with enough drive. But when it comes to politics, you better be pretty disagreeable, because there's no objective superiority about anything. We don't elect the smartest person. We don't elect the most moral person. We don't elect anything. This is all just, people just throwing spaghetti at the wall and voting their wallet and their instincts. That's what happens. And so as a result, what you're going to find is you're going to find a bunch of people that are inherently motivated to climb dominance hierarchies that are going to be trying to get to the top of one. So our last election was a fabulous case in point here, which you have Hillary and Donald Trump, two ferocious dominance hierarchy climbers. Like those, both of them have canine teeth 4 inches long, but both of them, they're absolutely ferocious. And so no surprise, who the hell guts all the way to getting the nomination of a major party in the United States? You got to have some serious push to do that. You don't have to have any particular talent. for anything. What you need is you need push, and they had it, both of them.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking in the lines of, you know, highly extroverted, you know, we wouldn't expect to see a highly introverted president because they got to shake a lot of hands, you know.
Sure.
But
right.
And yeah, obviously, I guess emotional stability. What's that?
Yeah, yeah. Like Nixon wasn't particularly extroverted. The you know, you wouldn't have to be extroverted. It would certainly help. Yeah, but the disagreeable, generally quite pretty emotionally stable, it would generally be the case. Trump would be an unusually volatile. You know, that's what freaks everybody out, is that he's a very, very emotionally volatile seeming character, comparatively to most politicians. But yeah. But really, I'd be in an incredible book called, I think it's called The King of the Mountain by, I believe it's Arthur Ludwig. It's an incredible tale and study of the politics in the 20th century. And this guy looks at every single country in the 20th century and its leadership patterns. And he goes through exactly the questions that you're sort of talking about, which is what makes a leader, what's charisma, and all this kind of stuff. And pretty much what he comes down to is mostly dominance. It's mostly just a desire to dominate other organisms, and that's pretty much what it is.
Wow. All right, I'll have to check out that book. That sounds fun. Well, speaking of leadership, what's that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So speaking of leadership, our next question is about standing up and speaking in front of a class. And so in previous podcast, you had answered about giving presentations. So this listener writes in, Dr. Lyle, you've answered a question about giving presentations, and I wondered whether you'd give the same advice to a high school teacher. In one of my adolescence education classes this term, we presented lecture demos. One of the rules was no self-effacing humor. Is there a different cost benefit of self-effacing humor in a high school classroom? Are there any other ways that teaching high school might have to be approached differently than public speaking in general? Or is it really the same?
It's not necessarily the same. And I think there's some overlap there, obviously, but it's not quite the same thing. Because when you're making presentations to the world, you're not speaking to the same people every day for 200 days out of, you know, the year. So it's a little different situation. So when you're making a public presentation, if you are clever, what you're trying to do is you're trying to soften the blow that you're actually in charge and that you've been put in charge of the village and that they're in a subordinate position. And so there's that contrast. Remember, they have allowed themselves to be put in that contrast in most situations. Sometimes not. Sometimes they have to be there and listen to you because they have some credit that they have to get, or that they're expected to be there for some reason, at which point they're a very uninterested crowd and latently hostile. But we're going to assume, for the sake of argument, that people have come because they believe that you have earned the right to have their attention. However, that doesn't mean that they don't have a, well, we'll just see attitude. And so, there's sort of a de facto, I'm in charge, undercurrent when you're the speaker. Like, hey, I'm talking and everybody else needs to shut up and listen. So that's you're assuming a dominant position. Now, so that to me is socially dangerous. In other words, there's a lot of reason why there would be some resistance to this. So that's why I use self-effacing humor, is that I am signaling to the audience that I am not looking down on them and that I'm not, you know, seizing control or power, etc. So I'm breaking down that distinction between the two of us and I'm making this thing like I'm very willing to be a peer and look at them eyeball to eyeball as opposed to looking down. So that's the reason for that process, as I described. Now, in a high school situation, they already know the score. They already know you. There's already you are actually literally in a position of power. You are grading these people. They don't have a choice as to be there, etc. So it's a different social situation. Now the question is, would you use self-effacing humor? And the question would be, why would you want to? And one of the reasons would be that you would want to be softening the issue that you are looking down on them or talking down to them. But remember, there's less latent resentment, even though you may think that there is more, but there's less because these people are not considering themselves your peer. You know, you're 10 or 20 or 30 years older than they are, and you're the teacher and they're the student. So that's a very different situation than a normal presentation adult to adult out there in the world. Now, so our real problem is with our disagreeable people in the high school class. It's with the few individuals that actually have the same narcissistic push that we see in politicians that are resistant and frustrated that they are in a subordinate position and that they seek to trump the person that's at the top of the dominance hierarchy. So there's our problem. And so the question is, you know, would we use self-effacing humor with those individuals? And the answer is not necessarily. It depends upon what they're like and depends upon what the nature of the relationship seems to be, et cetera. Generally, what I would do instead of that is that I would be giving those people status when they earned it. When they tried to smart off and be shitty, I would find ways to not be giving them status. But I'm trying to think through what this person is really asking in this question. So I'm kind of talking around these issues as I'm trying to imagine the worst case scenario in a class and what this person would be worried about as a high school teacher. So could you use self-effacing humor? It depends on the class and depends upon why you're using it. So if you've got a very warm class and you are trying to signal that you like them and that you don't need to always be in this dominant position, then self-effacing humor is extremely charming and the kids will love you for it. Okay, and so anybody that says that you shouldn't use that, it doesn't understand and doesn't have any talent. So they haven't pulled this off. Of course you can do that. But would you necessarily under certain cases and certain tough cases, you would not necessarily do that because you wouldn't want to expose the weakness. So one way to think about this is in the following way. And that is that self-effacing humor works very well when you can afford to lose the status, and it's what we're going to call faux status. So it has to be false status. It can't be real status. So I make a joke about my inability to draw, but that's faux status. I mean, is it losing a little bit of status? Not really. People can, number one, they can tell that I'm not really trying because nobody could be that bad. So, and second of all, it's completely unimportant relative to what it is that we're talking about and what my accomplishments are. So it's the loss of faux status, which is a charming process to use on an audience because that they can see that you're not fully yourself and that you're willing to look them eyeball to eyeball. You are willing to show the fact that you aren't just so high and mighty and fancy in all domains. Now, remember, it's faux status. So we're not going to want to use self-effacing humor over things that are more real. So we're not going to actually try to lose real status. I'm not going to go up there and talk about times in therapy cases where I've really messed up at some stupid things that I've done, in order to then see that I'm human and that I, you know, that I've made mistakes too. No, that isn't something that I would do. So the where we, you know, what self-effacing humor is, it's got to be humorous. It can't be, and to be humorous, it cannot be real status loss. It has to be faux status loss. So there's considerations here that are that have to be thought through. And but certainly there's going to be times and places in teaching a high school or teaching anything when self-effacing humor is wonderful, and it's a wonderful thing to use, and it will you know increase your rapport with an audience. There's other times when you know one should be careful and prudent when you feel like you're in a contentious situation. And you may not be able to afford that risk of that status loss, then I wouldn't do it. And there's going to be times and places where the right way to play is to play straight and not take those kind of risks.
Now, would you have any inferences over the administration of this particular adolescent education class to say that that one of the rules should be no self-effacing humor? We think that they're pretty disagreeable.
Not necessarily. In other words, there could be situations where I mean, this is where you're having to read who your problematic people are, and you're going to have to read the status that you have with the rest of the crowd, and you have to read that you can throw trial balloons at losing faux status and see if that improves your rapport with the most problematic people, which it might. Okay, so that's why there wouldn't be any hard and fast rules. It would be more a process of experimentation. And the kind of thing that I'm talking about is the way to analyze the problem. We're never losing real status. We're rigging it in a way that we're losing faux status. And we need to be in a position where we are good enough at what it is that we're doing that we've earned legitimate status through our other performances, but we are displaying a willingness to lose status when it's faux status. So that's how we would go about doing that. And that's actually very safe, but in situations where it's downright contentious, if you've got a really problematic group of people, then you probably wouldn't do that. You'd just be sending them to the principal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. All right, Dr. Lyle, our next question. Dear Dr. Lyle, my friend is sane but delusional. He so overestimates his abilities, his insights, and his possessions that he's consistently wrong but doesn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
As he approaches his senior years, he's on the way to leaving himself destitute. I'll help mm-hmm. him if it doesn't drag me down with him. But any mm-hmm. ideas?
Yeah. No. So the notion here is that anybody like this is pretty inherently disagreeable. So you're not just, if you've got delusions of grandeur, you've got along with it some disagreeableness, and that disagreeableness is leaking over into a bunch of narcissistic judgment that is resulting in the person making very poor decision making and therefore not recognizing some obvious realities. And so therefore this person is going to get increasingly expensive to deal with. So this is where I would say you get to a disagreeable distance where you're not on the first line for helping this individual. And there is no, remember that people need very little to survive. So probably they will have that very little, whatever that very little thing is. If they've been working, they've got some kind of Social Security, they can live in a trailer, they can share a trailer house with somebody in Tulare and or Visalia maybe, and they can be on food stamps and everything. You do not have to support them. So you don't have to support them at some level that their self-esteem feels better. They don't, or you know, that they feel better about them. Forget it. Okay, not your responsibility. It is unfortunate when someone is born with a narcissistic nervous system without the talent for anything to come out of that narcissism. Sometimes if someone's got some talent The narcissism will drive them to great efforts because they are getting enough feedback cues that indicates that they're likely to be victorious, that sometimes they'll work extremely hard and they will find their successes in life more than they would normally deserve as a result of an overestimation of their abilities. They basically put out more energy than someone of similar competence, but no delusion. So, so narcissism isn't necessarily a checkmate for some individual's ability to be successful in the world at all. It's practically necessary for a politician. Now, but this individual, if it turns out that they're headed towards trouble, your job is to absolutely not get sucked down with the vortex. So if it turns out that they're under some very humbling circumstances, there's a difference between humbling and seriously compromised. In the United States, it's very difficult to be seriously compromised. The truth of the matter is that you can find a safe, cheap enough place to live. It may not be comfortable and it may be embarrassing, but you can do it. And if you have to share a house with four other people in a mediocre part of town, and you're in, you know, I don't know, somewhere in, you know, Southwest Ohio, somewhere in some abandoned manufacturing town where the house rents for $850 a month and you got to pay a quarter of it, then hey, it's $210 a month and a few bucks. Your Social Security can support you. And so don't worry about this individual and their future. That was their problem to worry about it. And so that get yourself to a disagreeable distance and do not go down with the ship. That's just a natural consequence of a nervous system that was genetically haywire, and that's how it goes.
Wow. And yeah, I guess this is the same whether or not the person's family or not. But with the addition that if this person's family, then you're going to have more guilt chips being activated because you shared some genes.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, this is similar to what I will tell parents and other people when there's people that are addicted. So you've got a person that's got a 15-year addiction history and they're in and out of rehab, et cetera. And this is a tough go. It's essentially not their fault that they're in this mess. They didn't ask to be born into a world that has some horrendous chemical in it that they were too open and not smart enough to keep their snout out of. So they wound up getting addicted, and it's a mess. And so partly it's not their fault, but it's also not your fault. And so the fact that they may have a rough existence, it doesn't mean we're not going to be trying to be punishing or rejecting these people, but we're also not here to save them. And so I'll tell parents, hey, if they can't be in the house, they can't be in the house, because when they come in, they steal all of your stuff, then hey, no, they don't get to come in. But they should always know that, you know, there's going to be a bread box on the back door, and that there's going to be bread, and there's a sleeping bag, and they can sleep out in the yard and eat a loaf of dry bread. It's like they're not going to starve to death, and they're not going to be, you know, murdered in some alley. They've got a safe place to go. They can pitch a tent, but they're not coming in the house. So then that's before we get them into the homeless shelter. Okay. So there's always a way to deal with things that we don't have to be angry and we don't have to be rejecting. We just have to have boundaries and to be firm. And that's going to be the case whether we have a situation with someone who's addicted or whether it's a case where the person just has a really, you know, kind of a bizarre self-defeating personality structure, that's just how it's going to go. And, you know, in both cases, what we hope is that the person's a capacity to learn and the actual ability to make different choices, you know, may grow with every failure experience that checkmates them in a given time period, which is fine. And so very often we see people eventually work their way out of addictions, and we see narcissists that eventually choke down the realities of the marketplace and, you know, are greeters at Walmart. or somewhere like that. So the point is that it isn't that they're, they might eventually deal with their options, but we don't have to be buffering them against the discomfort that their decisions are creating. We do want to buffer them against tragedy, but those are two different things, and they are very different things.
Fascinating. And speaking of getting people out of these things or helping, this leads to our next question, which is, Dr. Lyle, my observation recently has been that the best way to get myself and other people to do productive and healthy things is by starting small, gradually increasing the difficulty of the tasks, and then doing them constantly until they become a habit. What's the evolutionary explanation for why we need habits in order to change ourselves?
Well, we don't need habits to change ourselves, so we can dispense with the ultimate question that the person has. So the what they're referring to is that they're referring to the fact that when you're trying to make changes, I'd say I'm going to back this whole question up, and we're going to try to understand the motivation for change and then the challenges associated with change. So the reason why you would change a pattern of behavior is because you come to believe that there's a superior pattern of behavior in terms of cost-benefit payoff. Now, there would be a number of reasons why you might change your mind. In other words, the reason why you're doing things the way you are doing them now is because your mind has analyzed that this is the best payoff, that this is the best CB ratio, and that all other alternative patterns of behavior are not as good. So why do we buy our gas at that Exxon station and take our shirts to that laundromat? Because our brain has analyzed and looked at the options, and it says, this is what I think the best option is. Okay, so that's why you would continue to do that indefinitely. Now, the question is, why would we ever change? And the only reason you would change is if that you had new information that would suggest to you that the CB is better in another pattern. That is the only reason why you would change. Now, there would be several kinds of circumstances that could give rise to a shift in the CB. And one of those circumstances would be the fact that something changes in the environment and the previous option is no longer available. So now that gas station went out of business for a while because they're redoing their pumps, and now you start going over to this other gas station. And it turns out that at that other gas station, there's some cute guy or cute girl that works there and does the, rings up the register. And so they've got a little shop in there, and you go in there and get yourself a bunch of candy. So it turns out that maybe there's reasons why now you never go back to the other place, because now the CB has changed. So this is why it is that you make changes. How you make changes is simply the execution of the CB. Your brain runs the CB, and then it sends patterns of nerve impulses down the motor neurons that attach to muscles that make the muscles contract in a pattern that executes the behavior. That's all not very interesting to me. What's interesting to me is the computation in the brain that says, why did the CB change? Okay, now, what you're going to see is that very often, to see some very significant change of a pattern of behavior, is that very often the person will, for one reason or another, and it could be a multitude of reasons, they shift slightly what it is that they do. So they don't change something dramatically, they change a little bit. And when they change it a little bit, it turns out that that it seems like it's a better payoff. So let me give you an example. So one of my very first clients ever came to me and said that they were sent to me because they were told that they got something wrong with their head because they've got this diffuse joint pain all over their body and there's no reason for it. So they need to go talk to a psychologist, which was, of course, insane. That this was medical staff had given this guy this information, and it was ridiculous. I told the guy to quit eating all dairy products. Now, I didn't know how long to tell him to. I told him a month. which I didn't know anything. I had just read the McDougal plan, so that's what I told him. Well, he came back a week later and told me that all of his pain was gone in 48 hours. And that he had thought I was out of line and a nut, but he tried it anyway. And then he went and ate some cheese a couple, 3 days later, and the pain came back. And then he stopped eating it, and then the pain was gone. So this was about 7 days later, and he'd already gone through a period where he did what I said, got a good result, then went back and did it the old way, got the pain back, and then switched back, and then he's back out of pain. That whole thing took place in like 7 days. It's a very interesting set of experiments. So why did he do the experiment in the first place? Because somebody told him that there was a causal connection where he would have some control over an outcome. That's why. That there was a CB that he didn't know about, that there was an offering. So I had enough authority and enough confidence in my message that he bought it. He bought it enough to run a little experiment. So he runs a little experiment, and then he runs another little experiment, and then he runs a third experiment, is what he did, okay? And then subsequent to that, that guy didn't go back on dairy products, by the way. So I actually had follow-up on him for several years. So, and why was that? Because the CB changed, and he had made the causal connection as to what was causing, you know, he had now a better understanding of the cost-benefit analysis of the options that were in front of him. So he chose an option that was, you know, wound up being conducive to his reduced pain. Now, so that's when you make a little change, what can happen is that you can become more effective, because when the brain makes a change, it just grossly knows what behavior to do, but it doesn't know exactly what behavior to do because it hasn't had the structural changes in the brain enough to make it really efficient. So the first time you go over to grandmother's house, you know, in the snow, that you're not quite sure where you're going, and they tell you to take a left at the old barn and then a right, you know, at the big barn, and then you go down about a mile and whatever. So you're a little uncertain and you're not sure where you're going, and you take a couple of wrong turns. The next time you go, you're better, okay? The third time you go, you're better still. And so as a result, what's going to happen is once you make changes, if they were worth making the first time, then when you make them on subsequent occasions, you're going to get increasingly efficient, very likely that you will improve. So the new CB, you got lured into a change because by some factor of the environment. So some new information came in, some gas station was closed, you know, some you had to have your clothes washed, you know, on a given day, and your place wasn't open on Saturday, but these other people were, and they had 4-hour service. So you tried something new. So by hook or by crook, your existing pattern of behavior winds up getting challenged by an alternative course of action, causing your behavior to mutate a little bit. Now, if it turns out that results in an improvement, now you go down a new direction. And as you go down that new direction, you very likely may learn as you go. So if the first move is worth it a little bit, then the next move is worth it a little bit more, and the third move is worth it a little bit more. And now we have a new pattern of behavior. Okay? Now we would call that a habit. So to say that we, quote, why do we need habits to make changes? We don't need habits to make changes. Habits are the result of changes in our cost-benefit analysis that lead to an experimental change in the behavior, which lead then to very similar behavior changes taking place repetitively in the future, which leads to a more sophisticated ability to execute what's important in that CB offering, and to get it done easier, faster, cheaper, with less hassle. And as a result, that becomes what you and I now call a habit change. So that's what actually takes place.
And as we all know, it takes 21 days to create a habit, right, Dr. Lyle? Just kidding. I know that's a myth.
So all these beautiful little platitudes and myths out there, some of them which have bits of truth in them, but mostly just a bunch of talking heads with no information in there, just trying to make some money. What the hell?
So, Dr. Lyle, I have a question.
Try that sometime.
on our Facebook group, Facebook group, the fans of the Beat Your Genes podcast, there's a thread of the listeners who just love all the sayings that you come up with. Like, one of them was, "Wouldn't even give her a sack of potato chips." You know, that's one of the phrases. And I think we just identified a new one that I just want to know the meaning of it. What does "by hook or by crook" mean? I've never heard that before.
Oh,
I like it.
That's funny. I don't even know where that comes from, but I think that's a really old one. And so I think it's it might have come from fishing. I have no idea, but by hook or by crook is the notion of by some method we're going to get this thing done. Somebody could look that up, but that's probably something out of the 18th century.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.